Another big show for you on Wednesday, May 13th, right here on Connecticut Today. We talked to Garrett Sheehan, who heads the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce, about how the businesses he's talking to are dealing with the coronavirus outbreak. We took a break, got into politics with a professor who's written a new book about Republican populist operative Steve Bannon. We gave you portions of Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus briefing, which included hearing from two state legislators who both run restaurants. And the 5 o'clock hour kicked off with an update from our buddy, State Senator Kevin Kelly, Republican of Stratford. Our next guest was with us, oh boy, at the outset, I think, of this coronavirus thing, just when we were being confronted with what was ahead of us some 8-10 weeks ago. He joins us, the president and CEO, again, of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce, to give us an idea as to what he is hearing, what his members are saying. And we welcome to the program here Garrett Sheehan, who's with us again. Garrett, Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing good. I do remember that call. It feels like that might have been a year or two ago. But, it was only about 10 weeks ago. And I don't even think at that point in time in that conversation we talked about COVID-19. We were talking about a lot of other business issues. So the world has changed.
Yeah, I mean, all stuff about, Garrett, everything we talk about, minimum wage and government regulation and all this and getting members to join up. Wow, it certainly does seem like a lifetime ago, doesn't it? And you said it was only 9 or 10 weeks ago.
That's right.
How is your member? What are you hearing, Garrett, from your membership? What are the members of the chamber there, along the shoreline in the Greater New Haven area? What are they saying about this? What are you hearing from them? Their thoughts, calls, their worries, whatever.
Yeah, it's all over the place. I mean, there's a lot of let's just start with there's a lot of devastation of especially of our small businesses. Either they've been forced to close because of government order, or they've just closed because the business is not there. I think I was just hearing your ad about advertising, and one of the problems we have right now is just that because of the concerns that everyone has, not only about health, but also about what's going to happen with the economy overall, consumers, even businesses, are just not spending money, and that just has a cascading effect on our economy overall. So we're hearing those stories of all these businesses that are really suffering, and it's horrible situation. We are starting to see some of our businesses get some of that federal stimulus money. That's a good thing. That's what they need to be able to get through at least these next few weeks, where hopefully we'll start to see a little bit more economic activity. And definitely there's the concerns about health, and even as those apply to the reopening, I don't think anyone can say that they go into a more increased economic activity time without some level of concern. At the same time, we want to get things moving and get things going again.
Garrett, I know that you are among, I believe, the people that has voiced their opinions and whose brains are being picked, I know, by Governor Ned Lamont. Have you had any direct conversations with him or his staff? How have those gone for you?
Yeah, no, it's a good experience. We're definitely not the decision makers. It's the governor's call, and we're not sitting now, deciding this business versus that business. The role of the advisory committee has really been working with DCD, the Department of Economic and Community Development, and just sharing what's going on and the comments and concerns we hear from businesses. And definitely as a business organization, we're for opening more businesses, but at the same time, we understand the health issues. And I think part of my role is to push for those openings and then let the health experts push back. Definitely we cede the stage to them at some points on the health concerns. No one wants to further the spread of this. We want to stop the spread. But we do at the same time understand the real economic issues that are impacting so many businesses. I do think it's important to mention, and I've noticed this just looking across the country, even at the start of this, Connecticut and the governor, David Layman, were very good about not closing everything. You look at many states, there were much deeper closures as far as businesses. And our starting point, where we are right now, We do have a lot of things that have remained open throughout the pandemic, and I think that's a great testament to our businesses because they've learned how to adapt. You look at our manufacturing, grocery stores, any type of these other stores that have been open, you walk in, they're using innovation to find ways to keep their employees and their customers safe and still keep activity going.
Garrett Sheehan is the guest president and CEO of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce. Garrett, I'm glad you brought that up because as the governor mentioned, I think in a couple of times he's done it because we carry his daily update live here on WICC. He has said that something akin to 65 or 68% of the state's overall economy has stayed open. Now, that's no solace, though, to a lot of the service workers and smaller workers who are in that 30 or 35% that has been shut down. But I think you're right in saying this has not been a total clampdown here, although the state has lost such a significant a part of sales tax income and fees and things like that.
Yeah, and I do always caution when I say something like that, too, because I know if you're an individual business owner out there right now and you're closed, and let's even say that you're not part of that next round of opening, saying that other places are open is of little solace as you see all of your time and work get wasted here. But it is true, Paul. We have had a lot of our economy has been open, and we've been figuring out ways to make things happen, not at the scale that we need to have real economic activity going on, but business has continued in this state. So even when you look, and I think the term reopen is a little challenging just because we have so many businesses that have already been open, but as you look at the starting point where we are at right now, it is ahead of where a lot of the other states were coming out of the real severe point of the pandemic.
And we are talking about small business, as we have all throughout this coronavirus situation in Connecticut and Fairfield County. We spoke to the head of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council last week, and heading up the shoreline a little bit to the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce, Garrett Sheehan continues with us for a few more minutes. Garrett, obviously, I think you're hearing what I'm hearing here from both businesses and employees. First, you have businesses who are worried, and they have appealed to the governor on this. And tell me if you've heard some of this. Businesses who say, hey, I'd like to get back up and running here, but I'm worried about being legally challenged here if, unfortunately, some or one of my employees is struck with COVID-19 here. Are you hearing anything like that? And what are you hearing about any possible help for businesses on things like that?
Yeah, we definitely have heard from businesses, and it is a rightful concern about liability and how you control that. I understand that's one of the points of debate in the next federal stimulus would be liability protection for businesses in regards to this. On the state level, I haven't seen anything yet, but it definitely one of the things that I've raised with the advisory committee as well. I'm a part-time lawyer, so no advice here, but there's challenges. Obviously, in these types of there would be challenges in trying to identify that someone did get the virus specifically from your work site or going there as a customer. So there are definitely going to be some hurdles to those types of suits. I think that the best thing that people can do now is that since there are guidelines out there by the state. Follow those guidelines, and that kind of gives an initial roadmap of the best, what an ordinary business would do, the best kind of practice that they could follow.
And, you have so many of these businesses, Garrett, being told about guidelines, hair salons here, barber shops, restaurants. These are more Garrett, than just businesses that make money, want to pay their employees and feed the neighborhood. These many oftentimes are neighborhood staples of certain areas of New Haven and Bridgeport and surrounding towns and areas all throughout Connecticut, Garrett, that, yeah, they're in a profession to make money and to pay their employees. But I said this the other day, I think getting these places up and running is so important for the psyche of who we are as a people in this area.
It's true. And I do want to mention on the guidelines as well. The guidelines are very thorough. They're out there. But I also would tell businesses all the time, you got to use common sense. It would be very difficult to get down to every detail that's going to apply to every single business out there. And the overall goal is to stop the spread. And so it's keeping distance between people, wearing masks, things like that. So business owners are going to have to, in their own physical space, which is not the same as the next business over, going to have to figure out and make those calls based on common sense and the best way that they can protect everyone. But you're right, having those types of local businesses that are really the heart and soul of a neighborhood, a town, even a city, that is an important first step to getting this economy back going.
Where do you think, Garrett, where do we end up maybe 6 months or a year from now? Any guesses on that? What are you hearing from your members right now? Any shot as to how much of a reboot we can expect here? What do you think?
Boy, that's the million-dollar question there. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. It's so much of it depends on what happens with this virus, obviously. There's challenges out there. There's challenges of just getting things restarted right now. But also, we have now months of essentially a global slowdown in the economy overall. So, I mean, we could see a second economic phase. I don't think that's out of the question as well to even some of our larger companies, because so much of this right now has just been small business. It's actually been very different than normal recessions in the sense of that it started at the bottom and moved its way up in general, whereas normally these things start at the top and move their way down into the other parts of the economy. So we just don't know how that's going to work. I heard you talking before. I mean, people are getting these extra stimulus dollars that to the extent that they feel comfortable spending them. That really gets us moving. It takes a lot of small spends to start to add up, but it does start to instill confidence in everyone and starts to get things moving in the right direction. One thing I tell everyone is, there's not going to be, from what we've seen, there's no silver bullet. We're going to be living with this virus for a while.
Yeah.
And so we just need to find a way to live with it. And I hate to say that. I wish we could take all the danger and risk out of it, but we're going to need to find a way to do business, be as safe as we possibly can, but knowing that there is still that risk out there.
If someone is listening to us, Garrett, they run a small business or are involved in the decision-making of it, and they do not belong to their local chamber of commerce, wherever that may be, Greater Bridgeport or New Haven or Hartford or wherever, Lower Fairfield County, what would you tell them as to why they should get involved in their local chamber or their business organization?
Well, this time period has shown the value of the chambers, if you did not know it before, because I can speak for our chamber, but I know chambers across the state have done this, working with all businesses, whether they're members or not, and talking through the stimulus programs now, the reopen guidelines. We've probably done close to 30 webinars. We're not checking if someone's a member or not, and talking through different issues, because there's just so many different levels of issues, even how you do sales now in this different environment. So I appreciate the opportunity to plug chambers. Chambers are of incredible value during normal times, but especially now, even with us, we're having our team available for a phone call, a Zoom call, whatever, so that we can talk through the issues that are specific to your business.
All right, the New Haven Chambers website, gnhcc.com, gnhcc.com. Garrett Sheehan has been the guest, head of the Greater New Haven Chamber of Commerce. Garrett, thank you. We appreciate the time. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. All right. Well, we are getting into the political season. Well, we're never really out of it, but COVID-19, the coronavirus, kind of, sort of, derailed us a little bit, but now we're getting back into it as we start to edge closer and closer toward the election. There's a fascinating new book out about a guy that pops into and out of pop culture every couple of months, War for Eternity inside Bannon's far right circle of global power brokers. And the author of that book is on the line with us right now, Benjamin R. Teitelbaum. Ben, hi, it's Paul at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Pleasure to be with you today.
Are you social distancing from your home in the Midwest? Everything okay?
Always, always. You know, I live high in the mountains, so we've been social distancing this whole time, you could say.
Very nice. Well, people ask me, and they say, you're social distancing. I say, I've been doing it for 58 years. So, you know, it is.
Exactly.
It's what it is. Hey,
radio Steve, is a good place to do it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's my way of life. You know, I'm the guy that goes to the party. I sit in the corner with nobody behind me and watch everybody. Steve Bannon, fascinating guy. Why the new book about him, though? Is it because you think he is going to make his presence felt again as we get toward November?
That wasn't my motivation, although that may be true. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a journalist. I'm a professor. I'm a scholar.
I saw that. Yeah.
And I was really interested in just an aspect of Steve's thinking that had been understudied. No one was really talking about it, and I fancied myself knowing just how strange it was, and wanted to write a book about that. In the midst of writing the book, all of a sudden some things started happening with him, and started to realize that this wasn't just a nerdy exercise for a professor. I certainly claim the right to do research on things that are irrelevant. That's the privilege of a professor, but, you know, it so turns out that there's a lot going on. There is a lot to be said just about this story. So that really is why this is a popular as opposed to an academic book.
He is a fascinating guy. He is not, and as you can imagine, doing a show like this, I eat, sleep, drink, feel politics 24/7. Bannon is not, Benjamin, he's not a nerd. He's not a policy wonk. He's a ruddy-looking 66-year-old guy who's been in the Navy. He's been an investment banker. He's produced movies. I mean, this guy is not out of central casting for a policy wonk here.
Oh, my goodness, no. No, and the big, you know, the missing piece of that brief overview that you just gave, which I hope that my book can start to shed light on, is that he's also something of a spiritualist. In a very, very unusual way, extremely unusual way. And it just complicates the picture of him. This is one of the reasons why, as you said, you know, pop culture, you know, they hate him, they dismiss him, but he keeps showing up again. He's too fascinating, I think, for people to stop debating and to let go of completely.
And you're right, because I saw a clip of him, and you obviously saw this. He was on a few weeks ago again with Bill Maher, and Maher loves having him on because of how they can debate. And you're right. It's not like when you ask Bannon or you debate him that you're watching, you know, the McLaughlin Group or Meet the Press or whatever. You know, it's like, Benjamin, it's like arguing politics with a guy at a bar or over a card game. It really is.
Yes. Yes, I mean there's a gut, for lack of a better term, I mean just kind of a directness in the way that he deals with things. What makes it complicated is this. I mean, you mentioned, Paul, that he was in the Navy. One thing that I talked to him about a lot in preparation for the book is that, you know, while he's traveling around as a pretty gritty Navy guy, young guy, you know, bars, you know, drinking, fighting, all the rest. You know, when he gets to a lot of these port cities that the U.S. Navy would dock in, he would also sneak off by himself and take himself to the nearest New Age bookstore.
Hmm.
How does that fit with everything?
Yeah, really. We'll try and figure it out. Fascinating new book out. It's about Steve Bannon. You know about him. War for Eternity, Inside Bannon's Far-Right Circle of Global Power Brokers. College professor and author Benjamin Teitelbaum is the guest. Ben, it says here, obviously, you were able to interview some of his people that he hangs with, his inner circle. Before we get to that, were you able to speak to Steve Bannon himself for this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have 20 hours on the record, okay, and at least that much off the record. Yeah.
What did you think of him? Just give our listeners. I mean, a lot of our listeners have seen him on the talk shows and seen him in the midst of the campaign. What did you think as you talked with him?
An exceptional person. I mean that kind of in the neutral sense. I've never met anyone like him. More energy. I know I'm not that old, Paul, but he has more energy than almost anyone I've ever met in my life. Unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah.
So he's kind of one of those guys. I was thinking about asking you this because I know a couple of these people in radio, one of whom has become very, very, well, I'll tell you, I used to work with Glenn Beck. And the thing about Glenn, I will always remember, Ben, is that he didn't have an off switch. Is that the same thing with Bannon?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one way to put it.
And then and the wheels are still always grinding. So you talk with him about what? Did he know the kind of book you were going to write?
Yes. It took him a while to warm to it. We had a couple conversations off the record first because it's pretty sensitive. It's pretty, you know, kind of delving into ideology that's very rare and pretty incendiary. So it took him a while, but then eventually he warmed to it.
Does he consider his ideology incendiary, or was he trying to tell you that you've got them all wrong?
Well, he probably wouldn't, you know, he has a version of it. You know, I think he'd be happy with me calling it radical, which it certainly is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's far beyond the bounds of what we're used to thinking about in terms of politics. You know, but he was pretty eager always also to specify and clarify, and I hope that I relayed this in the book too, that he has his take on it. He's one of the few people in history to take this particular set of ideas and try and fit it to American nationalism. So he's working in hybrid, but he was, you know, he understands also that he sees himself as a rebel. And as someone who is there to disrupt the political mainstream. So I don't think terms like radical bother him too much.
So he sees what he does as a necessity, as some sort of manifest destiny. Is that what he thinks?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we can briefly back up for your listeners.
Sure.
I mean, he follows away an ideology. It's called traditionalism, capital T. I wish it had a funkier name so we'd know how offbeat it is. But he believes that we're at a stage right now in world history where our largest political institutions and entities need to be broken down, that they're too large. That there's a world government essentially functioning under the guise of global free trade and the United Nations, global democracy, human rights, and things like that. And he wants to see it all fractured. And this is partially what motivated him to support Trump, as he saw Trump as someone who would come and disrupt one political entity, namely the U.S. federal government, someone who would break it down. But this is a guiding ideology for him that, again, has some very, very eccentric roots. It actually, a lot of it comes from Hinduism, believe it or not.
Really? Hinduism?
Yes.
See, the common, if you mention Hindu and Steve Bannon to most political scientists, they say, hey, Ben, the stuff you're smoking, where did you get it from?
Yeah, exactly.
You know? But again, that's what fascinates me about the guy is he's almost kind of a populist, right-wing, deep-thinking kind of, you know, kind of, what is that sculpture? The Thinker, you know, where he has his, you know, resting it with a MAGA hat on, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's what's so strange about him. That is that he's all of those things. And a lot of the book is about trying to understand how they can all coexist with one another.
It says that you had interviews also with his inner circle. Who give us some? Can you give us some names? How were they?
Sure.
Did Bannon go to them? Did they gravitate to Bannon? Give us an update on that.
A little of both, especially. I mean, if you or any of your viewers do follow Glenn Beck, you might know about a notorious Russian philosopher named Alexander Dugin. Not a fan of the United States by any means, but he also adheres to this philosophy I was talking to you about. And he's an influence on Russia's military apparatus, very, very prominent thinker there. And Bannon and he met in 2018, really in the course, in the middle of my research. They met in secrecy in Rome. I spoke to Dugin about their meetings on multiple occasions. They were trying to discuss ways to advance a common vision for Bannon that involved trying to bring Russia into greater alignment with the United States. So Dugin is one. Another figure who Bannon has been connecting with on these same issues has been a man named Olavo de Carvalho, who is the guru of Jair Bolsonaro, who's the president of Brazil and a big fan of Donald Trump. You know, like Bannon, he is an exceptionally complicated figure who also has this mix of populism with occultism and alternative spirituality and stuff, also a Catholic, though. And they have connected. They've been working on projects of mutual interest, primarily bringing Brazil into greater alignment with the United States against China. So all this has been, you know, are things that I chart in the book.
Man, this must, when you're doing these interviews, Ben, you must, I mean, I've done interviews with people like this, and I sit back and it's, you know, when we're done, you know, a few hours later, my head is still spinning from all this stuff. I mean, it must have been for you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, one, I mean, when you talk about someone who has no off switch, sitting and speaking with Steve Bannon and Alexander Dugin, the Russian figure,
yeah,
you're just hit with so many ideas. And in Steve's case, it almost is like he's speaking five sentences at once. And really, I'd have my interview with him, and I'd have to go back to my research assistant. We would transcribe from the recording, and I'd read what he'd wrote, and I would, you know, then I would get a sense of what he was saying. But it's very difficult. It just washes over you in the moment.
Benjamin R. Teitelbaum is the author. A few more minutes with him. The book, it's about Steve Bannon, War for Eternity Inside Bannon's Far-Right Circle of Global Power Brokers. Ben, you and I both know that the successful political consultants are really good at one or more things. The reason they get work and they're not just sitting flapping their gums on cable news is because they are good at what they do. They have perceptions. Why is Bannon good at what he does? Or was he, or why has he been good at what he does? What did you sense about him that makes him listened to and in demand?
What a wonderful question. No one's ever asked me that before. And it has to be, this is almost somewhat anecdotally, because that's a hard question to answer, Paul, but I see in him an interest and a curiosity in so much. I mean, this is a guy who certainly has high level training in business and finance, but he also learned to become a sort of expert reader of polling data. And he also is interested in the culture sector. You know, as you said earlier, he makes films. I think it is a benefit to him that he can speak in all those different ways. You know, one problem I think that you can have as a political consultant or political scientist, even in the academy, is if you're kind of snowed into your one area, if you're kind of too quantitative or you're too qualitative or you're too much this or that, he encompasses quite a bit and can have conversations with a lot of people. And you know, what made him successful? He was one of the figures, even Donald Trump said this about him. He basically knew how the election map was going to look on election night if Trump was going to win. He said it was, you know, could have gone a number of ways, but if Trump was going to win, he knew which states were going to give it to him. He's one of the only people out there. So you have to think about a fusion of metrics, quantitative data, and some gut stuff based on you know, having a sense of the cultural zeitgeist of the country. All that stuff is moving around Bannon.
So he has that for the right, whether that's right-wing politics, populism, whatever. Is there an equivalent of him on the left, on the progressive side? Should they take take a lesson from Steve Bannon to what he's doing? I mean, I always say on this show that as much as conservatives hate her, Benjamin, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, she's kind of using the same MO that Donald Trump did, and she's now considered a leader on the left. Is there a left equivalent of Steve Bannon?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. I mean, I'm sure there is a figure out there. You know, there has to be someone who, you know, who has the resources, the energy, the interest, the background, the networking. You know, but no one at the moment. I mean, if you think of Dave Axelrod, you know, who is, you know, who figured so prominently Obama's.
Very smart guy. Yeah,
very, very smart guy. It's hard to envision him filling that same role, and I don't know who would fill it. They're media personalities who are quite prominent.
Yeah.
Ezra Klein, you know, Rachel Maddow can, you know, certainly churn through a lot of data, but not the same.
And on the left, Ben, you've got a lot of people that can write checks, too. I mean, listen, you and I both know George Soros has his fingers in a lot of things, but George Soros is certainly not Steve Bannon.
No, no. I mean, the equivalent there is resources and use of resources. I mean, you know, the number of projects that Soros is involved with is, you know, that's certainly comparable and surpasses that of Bannon's. But this is not someone who's as involved in the nitty-gritty of politics and not as interested in being a public figure. Steve, of course, is interested in also having his name recognized for the work that he's doing.
Well, listen, we all have a little bit of an ego. Final question as we run short on time here. After doing this, researching him, talking with him, you said, for hours, which I would dream of just to sit and shoot the breeze with him about politics, do you like him?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I mean, our politics are different in a lot of ways, but I have a hard time not liking someone who is as curious and as original as Steve. So, despite some political differences between us, I have no problem saying that. Yeah, I enjoyed the time I spent with him.
Did he like the book? What has he said to you about the book?
You know what? He has never given me comments on the book. You know, I gave him his quotes in advance, so I'm going to assume that he didn't think that, you know, there was any issue there. So, but I hope he likes it. I hope he gets a chance to read it. He's very busy. He's very distractible as well.
So. Yeah, and he's got the podcast now, which is getting a bunch of downloads. So yeah, he's never going to be in. He never will not be in demand. The name of the book: War for Eternity, Inside Bannon's Far Right Circle of Global Power Brokers. A lot of intrigue in that title. Professor Benjamin R. Teitelbaum is the guest. Professor, good to talk to you. Good luck with the book, and hopefully we can hook up in the future. Thanks.
Would love to. Thank you, Paul.
Just in a minute, who represent great eateries here in the state of Connecticut. And as you know, starting next week, May 20th, we're going to be doing partial reopenings of our restaurants for outdoor eating. And just want to hear two perspectives on that from folks who are in the legislature and also know a lot about fine dining. Tomorrow, as you know, is our day where we'll have the Reopen Connecticut Committee give an update on where we are now 1 week out from our May 20th opening date. I just figured I'd take a minute to tell you about Moody's Analytics. We are on the call this afternoon with all of the governors, and they brought in Moody's Analytics to give us an idea of what the fiscal situation was for the states as the House and the Senate now are thinking about what the next supplemental should look like. And Moody's Analytics was pretty interesting as they looked at a stress test of all the different states. And they said, look, most of the states were in reasonably good shape in anticipation of a normal recession. I would say that Connecticut was in better shape than most in anticipation of a normal recession. But this was no normal recession. As you know, our unemployment claims spiked up 20 times compared to a similar period during the last recession. And the fiscal shock on average for states is about 20%. That means their revenues are down about 20% from what they had budgeted. That's across the board. But there's incredible variation between the states, which I just wanted to talk to you about for a minute because I thought you might find it interesting. Two big variables about what hit states the hardest. One is the volatility of their income. And Moody's Analytics said there are two main variables there. Number one, in terms of your source of revenues, the progressivity or how steep your income tax is, that can lead to, you know, a fair amount of variability there. And that hits, you know, New York and New Jersey a little bit harder, Connecticut a little bit less, and some other states a lot less. And the other big variable is in source of income is energy. You know, I hadn't really focused on the fact that, you know, Wyoming and Alaska and North Dakota get a significant amount of their state budget paid for by taxes on energy. So in the case of Alaska, their revenues are down about 60%. In the case of Wyoming, they're down about 30%. You know, big gaps in terms of what they'd expected and what they're getting. Another big variable is on the revenue side is also the nature of your economy and how it's set up. And there are those states that rely, again, on energy got hit the most. Those that rely on tourism got hit. And you can imagine why. Aviation is down quite a bit. Everybody's discouraging travel. Hotels, we don't even have hotels open here for outside occupancy. And places like Florida are down about 24% in terms of their expected revenues. Big shortfalls. And one reason I mention that is because you've heard some of the comments as we think about a supplemental and how we help the states going forward is it's blue states and red states, and the blue states aren't managing themselves nearly as well as the red states. Well, in fact, you're going to find if you go through Moody's analytics that it's Wyoming, Alaska, Florida, Louisiana are the states that are hit in many cases by far the hardest, you know, given the sources of revenues and income they have, which I think is why I'm, you know, hopeful that we'll get some sort of a responsible supplemental through that allows us to get through this without having to raise taxes or cut spending dramatically. Connecticut's also in a better shape compared to our peers because a lot of our core industries kept going. These are core industries that do well in bad times as well as good. Healthcare being one. Education, we'll see, but right now education is still a good driver for us. Manufacturing, as you know, we never did close manufacturing. And right now they're working at a pretty good throttle, although Pratt & Whitney, because of commercial jet engines, had to furlough some people. But this gives us a fair amount of stability compared to a lot of our peers. And finally, we had a rainy day fund, which represented, you know, 12 or 13% of our overall budget. You know, that didn't put us at the top of the heap, but it put us in the top 10. And that was very helpful for us. Who's at the top of the heap? I can tell you that in terms of rainy day funds, Wyoming has a rainy day fund that was 140% of their overall budget. So that's because they have, it's like a sovereign wealth fund from Saudi Arabia. They have a lot of reserves from energy, but they needed it because they're so volatile going forward. Alaska had a rainy day fund, which was 85% of their total budget. We're about 13%, but that still put us near the top. So overall, Moody's gave Connecticut a pretty good record. They said because of the rainy day fund, because of the nature of your revenues being relatively stable compared to a lot of your peers, because you didn't close down as much of the economy, manufacturing, healthcare, education, for example, finance, we're better able to power through than some of our peers. But I really wanted to leave you with a message that it's so important that some sort of a supplemental come through, and I hope they reach a compromise. You know, with that, I can just tell you briefly on the daily summary you see here, the numbers just continue the same trend we've had now for, you know, 2-3 weeks. Positive cases spiked up a little bit. That's not a number that's meaningful in my mind by itself. It's meaningful as a percentage of the tests performed, and it looks to me like they're a little over 10% this time, but still overall a downward trend. Fatalities went up a little bit, and hospitalizations continue to go down, a key metric. You'll see on the next chart that hospitalizations are a key metric for the reopening is now going on, what is it, almost 3 weeks of continuity, which is very important. And you'll see that the positive test day-to-day in terms of the infection rate is on a downward trend as well. But what this economy means to us is fundamental to how we get it reopened. And I've always maintained that we're never going to get reopened and give the consumer confidence to go back to that store, to that salon, to that restaurant, unless they feel like we're putting public health front and center. And that's why we've tried to strike the right balance in terms of how we start reopening on next week, 1 week from today. And as long as the metrics continue on the trend they are, we'll be able to do that. And with that, I just really wanted to introduce two friends with perhaps slightly different perspectives on reopening. We can talk about salons. We can talk about the service industry. I really wanted to talk about restaurants. And as you know, we're opening up restaurants just for outside eating only starting next week. One of the first states in the region to do that alongside Maine, I think, and Rhode Island and a few of the other states, but not everybody is doing it. And some people think we should do it more aggressively. Some people think we ought to maybe be a little more cautious. So I've got Senators Paul Formica and Christine Cohen, each of whom are great friends who have fabulous restaurants. And I can't remember what order we said. So Paul, since let me just start with you. Flanders Fish Market, one of the great places to go, East Lyme. I think I recommend it strongly. I've been there before, and Paul will tell you a little bit about what his plans are going forward. And Paul, by the way, barbershops do open up in about a week. Paul Formica.
You can tell I need that barbershop, Governor. Good afternoon, sir, and thank you very much for all that you're doing and your team during this unprecedented time in our state's history. Thank you, too, for giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts today. Our leaders and legislators statewide stand ready to provide their input and assistance in this recovery. It was March 17th that we had to reinvent our restaurant business to best accommodate the health and safety of our customers and staff during this pandemic. We have a fairly large restaurant with a retail component and an established takeout service. We've closed rooms and turned off refrigerators and freezers and have done whatever we can to reduce costs to survive during this time. Our revenues are down significantly, but we are holding our own due to the fact that we have the greatest staff in the business and our support from our great customers. We started to offer curbside and delivery service to enhance our customer base. And the move to outside dining will be good for our customers to enjoy our products in a relaxed and safe environment. I have a deck and other outside space on our property to put tables out there. The forecast for the next 7 days, however, includes 4 days of rain. So while this may be a prudent and measured start, there are many restaurants, both large and small, that solely outside dining is not going to work for. Our industry needs to get our staffs working together. Again, we need to support the food supply chain as our wholesalers and distributors have suffered along with us. And restarting large fishing vessels, meat packers, and paper and produce companies will take some time. The opening of our beaches from Koskob to Stonington, rental units, museums, all or portions of hotels and casinos will dictate the number of people we will be asked to serve. We need to trust the great businesses and entrepreneurs that are the job producers of our great state to make their decision about opening their business and providing jobs and let them have the ability to open their businesses thoughtfully, professionally, and safely. Our nursing homes are overrun with infections, and the priority needs to continue to be to manage that better, to protect our residents and our great frontline health providers. I believe we can balance our physical health and our economic health in a way that is safe. Opening a restaurant or any business now is not the way, the same as it used to be. We need to recreate and develop new processes to manage people movement and product distribution. We need to ensure everyone has access to adequate levels of masks, gloves, and cleaners to sustain a seven-day operation. And we will need to be vigilant to quick changes in crowd size, product availability, and virus containment, including education to all of us, for our collective personal responsibilities to keep ourselves safe. I know I speak for our entire industry when I say we are ready for this challenge and look forward to collaborating with all of you to achieve our statewide recovery. And once again, Governor, I thank you for the opportunity to join all of you today and all of the great work you're doing. And, you know, we've been in the state a long time, and we want to be in the state a lot longer. And we support all of our industry and all of the great industries that we need to open up.
Well, Senator, thank you, Senator Formica. I really appreciate that. We'll talk a little more about the balance of as we get these things opened and how you're doing it thoughtfully at Flanders Fish Market. Senator Christine Cohen, I hear you got the best bagels in Connecticut, not just Madison.
Thank you, Governor, and thank you for inviting me to join you today. I do believe that both Senator Formica and I come at this from a unique perspective, not only as state legislators, but as longtime small business owners. And I just want to start, as Senator Formica said, echo some of his comments and give you and your team kudos for handling this unusual situation for which there is certainly no guidebook. I'm in the quick serve casual industry, and while my revenues have dropped significantly, my husband and I are so fortunate that we've been able to keep our doors open and our team members employed. It's far from easy, but we're making it work, also without a handbook on best practices. So for the most part, things have gone well. Our local health department has been a great partner, and our company and customers have been able to adapt to a new way of conducting business. We quickly contracted with an online operation to allow for us to take orders remotely and ensure minimal contact. Our employees all wear masks and certainly the gloves, which are frequently changed, and customers are given a pickup time, and rather than entering our store, their bag is passed out onto a table upon arrival or perhaps brought out to their car. And while no method is perfect, and we had to, in fact, send a message to our customers this past weekend to really be mindful of social distancing and to please wear masks, which brings to light a new burden on businesses as they think about reopening, which is how do we do business and police others? We now have to be concerned for our employees' safety as well as our patrons, and what does that look like for us? I had a business owner ask me earlier this week, you know, on a weekly call that I have with businesses, whether they could refuse service to a customer for not wearing a mask. And these are all good questions. And I know you, Governor, have received some thoughts on enforcement as well. Customer comfort levels are going to be dependent on other patrons' behavior to an extent we have not seen before. So now not only do restaurateurs and retail establishments need to be concerned with having superior customer service, cleanliness, and great products, now we also have to become extremely concerned with how other customers are behaving in terms of their own safety protocols.
Just heard last half hour from Governor Ned Lamont about how we are still apparently on some sort of a path to softly, as they say, soft, a gradual reopening of the state, although about 60% of it never shut down, 60 to 70% of it never shut down. Restaurateurs, two of them from the General Assembly, were featured. Republican State Senator Paul Formica, who runs the Flanders Fish Market, and State Senator Christine Cohen of Guilford, who runs Cohen's Bagel Company. They gave their input as to what they would have to do. But there has not apparently been, at least as we've seen in other states, a lot of input from the General Assembly on this one. There were a few eyebrows raised at the fact that the state, although federal money is going to pay for it, the state is going to be hiring a consultancy to help it reopen. Well, joining us right now to give his thoughts on that, Republican State Senator Kevin Kelly in the neighborhood of Stratford. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself, Paul?
I am trying, Kevin, firmly ensconced in the Wallingford Bureau, but I'm okay. This consultancy group, did this surprise you? Did you know that this was coming down the line, and what are they exactly going to do? Does anybody know?
Well, Paul, it certainly surprised us, particularly given the fact that this governor has not been consulting with legislators or legislative leaders. And in this country, we are still governed by the people. We have a government of the people, and the people need their voice at the table. And this is what's so surprising and disconcerting about what the governor's doing, because he's not dealing with elected leaders. He did appoint a 50-member Reopen Connecticut panel of people across sectors and industry that he was going to use as an advisory group, mm-hmm. albeit, you know, under, I'm going to say, non-transparent auspices of a charity or a nonprofit. But now we find out that he's not even listening to them. He's hired a rich consulting group out of Boston. They're not even Connecticut residents. And they're going to have three or four consultants advise the governor on what reopening is going to mean to the people of Connecticut. And so that really raised an eyebrow. And then when you see how much money he's spending, $2 million, $250,000 a week, Paul, that's good work if you can find it. But the problem is that many families in the state of Connecticut right now that lost their jobs can't even get unemployment because the governor hasn't fixed a way to get unemployment checks to these families. They're now visiting food banks in historic numbers. And if I were in his shoes, I think I would have taken that $2 million and looked at maybe putting it towards a new computer system to get those checks to the people in need, or maybe helping support or opening up more food banks or some PPE for our first responders and people in hospitals and nursing homes. Or even how about Chromebooks for kids in cities that they can't get to school and get the education that they deserve under our Constitution? There are so many other places this governor could have used the money to really help people and families. And to see that it's going to a consultant, when I just got to think to myself, Paul, in this great state of Connecticut with mm-hmm. places like Yale and Wesleyan, yeah. That we've got the best and the brightest, that there weren't three or four people in the state of Connecticut, or even whether it's in the General Assembly or on that 50-member panel, that couldn't have stepped forward to help the governor get through this and help him, give him the advice that he needs.
Do you think, Kevin,
Connecticut?
Do you think, Kevin, it might have been, and I'm not going to put words in the governor's mouth, I have no idea what he was thinking here. Do you think it might have been a scenario where he wanted to avoid what's going on in, say, states like Michigan and some other states where you have legislators who don't necessarily agree with the governor making it very vocal? Do you think that may have had anything to do with keeping a lot of this, the nuts and bolts things, away from the legislative process, even though you guys and gals are technically not in session anymore? But do you think there was, you know, this kind of a firewall there that he intentionally did?
Well, Paul, I have to smile at the question, because that's what politics is. It's the marketplace of ideas. And if you don't have the appetite or stomach for somebody that may have a different view of the same reality, then politics and government isn't the place for you. I mean, quite frankly, when you volunteer to get involved, you recognize there's Republicans, Democrats, neither one is right or wrong. They're different. It's a different viewpoint. They all want to get the community to a better place, but they have different methods to get there. And what you do in the legislative process is you work through your ideas. You talk it out. You converse. You have the conversation. That's why government is different than running a business. Running a business is what the governor's doing. He's not listening to the customers or the employees. He's just deciding, hey, this is what I think is good for the company, and I'm moving in one direction. And in this direction, he's doing it not even with people who are, quite frankly, going to be subject or governed by the rules and the reopening that they're coming up with.
Kevin,
so
what?
I,
What has the communication been like throughout this whole process between the entire General Assembly, the House and the Senate, and the governor's office? Is there anything you can give us? Can you give us a perspective on that or not?
Well, you know, what I'm seeing is initially, I think it was very well. It was very good. When he wanted to get the authority to be able to act through executive order, he was fairly collaborative and communicative with the legislative leaders to make sure that he got the authority that he needed initially. But as we experience each day of this situation, it seems he has drifted further and further away, where you start to see communication like from my leader, Senator Len Fasano, where he's saying that he's really not communicating. It's not collaborative. There might be a phone call where you get an opportunity to hear what they're going to say at maybe a press conference in an hour or so. But that's not the process. That's not how government works. Government works when there's collaboration, which means an exchange of ideas, a thoughtful process. Maybe you accept some of the ideas, maybe you don't, or maybe the two different perspectives take you to a third perspective that everybody can work for and work and accept. That's not what appears to be going on, and I think that is at the heart of the issue and the crux of the concern.
All right, we're at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. One final question I wanted to get in, or a final topic I wanted to touch with Kevin Kelly on. Kevin, you and I both know that a couple of weeks back, the Secretary of the State, in an effort to, she says, secure the vote or make the vote easier in November, if we're still having problems with the coronavirus, wants to, or says she will, send out absentee ballots to the entire state, ballot applications, rather, to the entire state, to give people the opportunity to do that. But she's doing this with her interpretation of a statute. And then, Kevin, you probably saw where she said she was looking for guidance from the governor's office and from the General Assembly. Now, what does she – do we know what she means by guidance from – you folks in the House and Senate? Do you have any idea what she's asking for?
Well, Paul, I think where she's going is she'd like to just have, you know, elections conducted all through absentee ballot.
Yeah.
To anybody that asks. Now, under current Connecticut law, that's a problem, both from a I'm going to say a constitutional issue as well as just a statutory issue. And I think that's where she's looking for the guidance from the governor and the General Assembly to see what can be done under current, once again, executive orders that we had just talked about and the authority that the governor has to see whether or not something like this is even feasible. You know, on the whole, I think if you look at someone who might be 65 or older, given the way that the circumstances have of this coronavirus has affected that demographic, I could see where somebody would have concerns and want to stay as sheltered in place as possible.
Sure.
On the other hand, you know, we do have to balance that with what the experiences in the great city of Bridgeport have been. Both in general elections against Republican and Republican gubernatorial candidates, as well as in mayoral elections where, you know, primaries where the Democratic Party had irregularities. And I think at the end of the day, when you look at this issue, the one thing that you want to make sure on all accounts is that the sanctity of the vote is protected. So that's what needs to be the focus. To make sure that when you cast your vote, you know that your vote is not only going to count, but it's not going to get watered down by, you know, bags of votes found someplace in City Hall. Unfortunately,
so,
we laugh, but that's the
experience. Yeah, I know. So at this point, we're not really sure then what she means specifically, Kevin, by guidance from you folks, you guys and gals in the General Assembly. That's kind of, you're saying that's kind of a nebulous thing at this point.
Yeah, I think it's a request for a conversation with legislative leaders and the governor. to see if we can't get to common ground. You know, this is like what we were talking about on reopening Connecticut, mm-hmm. to get to a common ground to see if everybody could support it. I mean, there's going to be a fiscal issue. If she's mailing these ballots to everybody, is there money in the budget to do that?
Yeah.
And then there's just issues with when that's done. There's current state law requirements on how that's done, and, you know, how is she going to comply with that? So there's a that's where the guidance comes mm-hmm. in. That's where we need to have a conversation and a discussion. That's the way our government works. That's the normal protocol that I think people expect. But it's not what's happening when we look at the reopening Connecticut, as we discussed before. It's, you know, you have a few individuals, the governor, a couple consultants from Massachusetts that are going to tell, you know, the 99% of us, the rest of us, you know, how to reopen. And that's just not the way the process is supposed to work.
All right, Kevin, thanks. Keep us up to date. We do appreciate it. Kevin Kelly, Republican State Senator from Stratford. Stay safe, Kevin, and we'll talk. Thank you.
You too, Paul.